Okay, now, before we get started, I've got some handouts here, because we are not going to understand this unless we have some handouts. And we're going to be going through chapter 6 tonight and next Wednesday night, so make sure you got these with both nights. This chapter made a lot more sense to me when I came across these pictures. Pictures worth a thousand words. So helps for clarity here. Okay, let's read. Let's read through verse 13. We'll read verses 1 through 13 of 1 Kings chapter 6. Now, we're in Solomon here, and Solomon, remember, is from 1 Kings 3 through 11. Somebody give me the reign of Solomon again. Anybody? 970 to 930 B.C. Okay? And the first verse is going to tell us here that he started building the temple in the fourth year of his reign, so 966 B.C., when he starts to build the temple. Okay, let's read verses 1 through 13 of 1 Kings 6. And it came to pass in the 480th year, after the children of Israel had come out of the land of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, in the month of Ziv, which is the second month, that he began to build the house of the Lord. Now the house which King Solomon built for the Lord, its length was 60 cubits, its width 20 cubits, and its height 30 cubits. The vestibule in front of the sanctuary of the house was 20 cubits, long across the width of the house, and the width of the vestibule extended 10 cubits from the front of the house. And he made for the house windows with beveled frames. Against the wall of the temple he built chambers all round against the walls of the temple, all around the sanctuary and the inner sanctuary. Thus he made side chambers all around. The lowest chamber was 5 cubits, the middle was 6 cubits, and the third was 7 cubits wide. For he made narrow ledges around the outside of the temple, so that the support beams would not be fastened into the walls of the temple. And the temple, when it was being built, was built with stone finished at the quarry, so that no hammer or chisel or any iron tool was heard in the temple while it was being built. The doorway for the middle story was on the right side of the temple. They went up the stairs to the middle story and from the middle to the third. So he built the temple, finished it, and he paneled the temple with beams and boards of cedar. And he built side chambers against the entire temple, each 5 cubits high. They were attached to the temple with cedar beams. Then the word of the Lord came to Solomon, saying, concerning this temple which you are building, if you walk in my statutes, execute my judgments, keep all my commandments, and walk in them, then I will perform my word with you, which I spoke to your father David. And I will dwell among the children of Israel, and will not forsake my people Israel. May God commit the reading of his word to our minds, hearts, and wills tonight, for his glory, our eternal good, by his Spirit. Where are your priorities in life? Put God first in all your endeavors. I've shared this illustration before, but it always interests me because we're getting into construction here and all this tonight. Well, I've shared this before, but we had people we knew. They were retiring, and they let us know that they had gone down to the Ozarks, and they had this beautiful lot on a lake down there with all the pine trees and everything overlooking the lake, and they couldn't wait to get down. They were constructing this retirement home, a great big home and everything, something they'd planned for years. So they had the construction project, and they got down there, and then they realized when they were going to go to church on Sunday morning, they couldn't find a Bible-believing church, Bible-preaching church, and they ended up going 60 miles one way. Where are your priorities in life? Put God first in all your endeavors. And that one always sticks out to me, is God knows where their priorities are, and they were wrong. God will bless those who put Him first and honor Him. 1 Samuel 2:30, you honor God, He'll honor you. 1 Kings 6:1 through 38, cross-reference is 2 Chronicles 3:1 through 17. Introduction now, this is not mere construction, ho-hum details, and I'll flesh that out a little more. Outline is God's deliverance in verse 1, God's dwelling, its exterior structure in verses 2 through 10, 36 through 38. And then God's demand, verse 11 through 13, and then God's dwelling, its inner structure, is verses 14 through 35. So when we get into Solomon's construction here, we're in chapters 5 through 7. By way of introduction here, according to a recent newspaper report, the world's richest man is put in order for the world's largest yacht. The Sultan of the Middle Eastern Kingdom of Brunei is having the luxury vessel built at the Lucerne shipyard in Bremen, Germany. Cost of the yacht will exceed $60 million, and the new craft is designed to be bigger than the current record holder, a 480-foot yacht owned by the King of Saudi Arabia. I'll never forget when I was at the office, a patient, and he lived out in St. John's Lake. And he had a call from a fellow in the congregation on a Saturday morning. And the guy, he answered the phone, and this guy directly says, "How long is your house?" And his response was, "Well, I suppose if you count the garage, maybe 94 feet. And the guy said, "Mine's 106. Click. Reports of wealthy people spending huge amounts of their wealth and energy on personal pleasure is nothing new. That's the way the world has worked since time began. But Solomon was one king here. He reserved the best, as we've cited here, with the abundance that he got gathered together for the Lord, for the temple, for God and for His glory." And chapter 6 here is going to remind us that Solomon's determination to honor God was an attitude that he inherited from his father David. Turn to 1 Chronicles 28:9. It's been a verse that I've circled in my Bible. Every Bible I've ever owned, I think I circled this one. 1 Chronicles 28 Verse 9, David's advice to his son Solomon. "As for you, my son Solomon, know the God of your father and serve Him with a loyal heart." Now remember, "know" here is used in the sense of intimacy, just like Adam knew Eve and Seth as a result. So yes, you have to know about God, but knowing about God, it doesn't stop there. Knowing about God leads to fearing God, loving God, worshiping God, honoring God, etc. "As for you, my son Solomon, know the God of your father. Serve Him with a loyal heart and with a willing mind. For the Lord searches all hearts, understands all the intents of the thoughts. If you seek Him, He will be found by you." Think of Jeremiah 29:13. If you seek me, you will find me if you search for me with all your heart. Jeremiah 29:13. "He will be found by you, but if you forsake Him, He will cast you off forever." Now, when you look at this chapter, what's your initial reaction? When I read that, you could say, ho-hum here, let's move on to something else. And if you're not into construction, then it even heightens that kind of a feeling. But we have to stop ourselves on our tracks, though, don't we? Because Psalm 119:160, God's word is truth in its reality. Every word of God is truth. Every word. And 2 Timothy 3:16, everything is God breathed out and is profitable for instruction. What is it? Correction. All scriptures, God be done, profitable for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, for instruction in righteousness, that the man of God may be mature, thoroughly furnished unto every good work. 16 and 17. So we know that there's more than building facts here for us, especially when we get to verses 11 through 13, because this is sandwiched in between the exterior and what's on the inner as far as the structure, verses 11 through 13. Even the construction facts, though, this is all revelation, God communicating his name to us. Solomon is building, but remember, the plans came from David and the overall originally from God. Everything here is under God's authority as sovereignty. And the writer, though, is going to include here some editorial comments amidst the details of this construction. The sacred is mixed with the secular here, and it's an intentional narrative strategy. God is before all things, and by him all things consist. Rules over all things, he works in all things, and he's glorified in all things. How does it start out? In verse 1, it came to pass. What does that mean? The predetermined counsel of God is now actualized. The predetermined counsel of God is now actualized. It didn't just happen, it came to pass. God's time, his way, all according to his preordained plan. So let's look at verse 1 here, God's deliverance. God's deliverance. 2 Chronicles 3, 1 and 2. 2 Chronicles 3, 1 and 2. Solomon began to build the house of the Lord at Jerusalem on Mount Moriah, where the Lord had appeared to his father David at the place that David had prepared on the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite, and he began to build on the second day of the second month in the fourth year of his reign. Now, anybody remember Mount Moriah, where it's first mentioned in Scripture? With Abraham, right. Mount Moriah is chapter 22 of Genesis, which is called the Binding of Isaac. The Binding of Isaac. Remember, Abraham started out, he chopped the wood for the sacrifice, and he started out with a couple servants, and they left a couple servants behind at a certain point. He said, the son and I will go ahead, and they went to Mount Moriah. And that was where he was going to sacrifice Isaac, and God provided the ram, the substitute, Mount Moriah. And then it mentions in that verse about David. Well, David in the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite, where he purchased that, 1 Chronicles 21, where the devil prompted David to take a census, member of the troops. Rather than relying on God, he starts counting his troops. Well, then what does God do? He sets the destroying angel there, sends and gives David choices there of how he should be punished. And he says, well, be punished at the hand of God. And the destroying angel there kills 70,000 men. 70,000. And then David purchased the threshing floor because the angel was going to destroy Jerusalem. And God stopped him. David there pleaded with God. And then to David there would make sacrifice, get things right with God. And he purchased the threshing floor on Mount Moriah. That's where the temple is going to be built. And one thing you know about the Jews, there's that repetition on dates and months and all that. They all have significance because it intensifies your history. It intensifies the fact that God has ordained and planned everything. It's going according to his plan. So when it says there he built on the second day of the second month in the fourth year of his reign, turn in your Bible to Ezra 3:8. Ezra 3:8. Right after Chronicles is Ezra. Ezra 3:8. Now in the second month of the second year, here we go, see, of their coming to the house of God at Jerusalem, Zerubbabel, there they begin to build the temple of Zerubbabel. See? Second day of the second month, same thing as Solomon, see, built. Now, it came to pass, go back in 1 Kings 6, came to pass in the 480th year after the children of Israel had come out of the land of Egypt. So it's dated from the Exodus. Exodus. Now, turn to Exodus 12, 40 and 41. Exodus 12, 40 and 41. Exodus 12, 40 and 41. Now the sojourn of the children of Israel who lived in Egypt was 430 years. And it came to pass at the end of the 430 years, on the very same day it came to pass, all the armies of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt. So there they use a number of 430 years. The sojourn was in Egypt. It says here the 480th year after they had come out of the land of Egypt. In the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, which is 966, in the month of Ziv, is in April or May, which is the second month that he began to build then the house of the Lord. This is chronology here, but what it is here is that the Septuagint, when it refers to this verse, has 440. The Septuagint, remember, 250 BC, Israelite scholars in Alexandria translated the Hebrew Bible into Greek, and what they did is they put 440 years here. 440 years. So, if you take 966 BC plus the 480, this verse is used in dating the Exodus time of Moses, you get 1446 BC. 1446 BC with Moses. A lot of times, you know, people will just say 1450 BC. And if you use the Septuagint, 960, 440, 1406, and a lot of times, you know, you've heard 1400 BC. As I've told you, when you get to a lot of these dates in the Bible, it's all right just to round them a little bit. Nobody's going to get too excited about it. So you end up with an early date of an Exodus, which is this one, early date of the Exodus. And then the other school, when I was in seminary, it was the late date of the Exodus, around 1200 B.C., and you've got two schools of thought on that, on the dating of it. I tend to go with the early date, and because of the preciseness of this in verse, where it talks about the latter part of the verse, fourth year of the reign, and in the month of Ziv, and the second month, and all of that preciseness. But here again, it shouldn't divide believers whether you do one or the other, really. Now, look at verse 37. We read verse 1. Look at verse 37. Chapter 6 here, verse 37. In the fourth year, the foundation of the house of the Lord was laid in the month of Ziv. So it's kind of like two bookends here. It's doing in the chapter here. See, it just ties it all together. And really, it marks a new era here. Marks a new era. The 430 years in Exodus 12, 40 and 41 mark the end of the Egyptian bondage. And God, what it underscores here through all of this is God's faithfulness to his covenant. The end of the Exodus, I find this very interesting. Really, the end of the Exodus, the sojourn of Israel, the wandering of Israel, is when the foundation of the temple is laid. It's just like when you're going to date the 70 years captivity. Remember the time of Jeremiah? And Daniel 9:2, Daniel is reading and he realizes the 70 years are about up. Well, how do you date the 70 years exile? You go by the temple. So the 70 years exile, the temple was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar, Babylonian leader, in 586 BC, and under the time of Zerubbabel, we read in Ezra 3:8 there, when they laid the foundation for the temple, and that was
The temple was completed in 516 BC. Well, what have you got? You've got 70 years. And that's how you would date the captivity, the exile. All related to the temple. So when you get to the Jewish Talmud, one of my favorite quotes from the Talmud is, Israel is the center of the world, Jerusalem is the center of Israel, the temple is the center of Jerusalem. It always goes back to the temple. And it's just like when Jesus returns, the second coming, what will be the focal point is Jesus will go from the Mount of Olives through the Eastern Gate. Davis, in his commentary, had an interesting little chart here. Bible text, you got Exodus 12, 40, 41. Time, 430 years. The background to that, Genesis 15, 13, they would be in captivity. After 400 years, God said they'll. And the significance here is the end of bondage. The gift of freedom. And then you get to 1 Kings 6:1. We have 480 years. The background of that is the Davidic covenant, the promise to David that his son would build the temple. It's the end of wandering, gift of rest. And what's interesting here with this is what? Remember they had the tabernacle before the tent, and the tabernacle would keep moving during the 40 years of wandering. Well, who else, in a sense, was wandering with the children of Israel? God was in the tabernacle. So now what does he do? When he gets to the temple, he says, I have chosen a place to put my dwelling there. To put my dwelling there. God is also then chosen to have a place of his rest and more of a permanency connected with it. See? And we can draw a parallel of this at Grace Baptist. You see, God is omnipresent in that in his nature, and yet what can he do? He can choose a place to localize his presence, to increase its significance for all of us. And he does that with the church when we come to a meeting place. We should have that same sense when we come here, is that we come here to meet with God. Because God has chosen this place, see, for his presence in a special sense for his people. We can have that same sense. So what you have here is this underscores God's faithfulness to his covenant. God's faithfulness to his covenant. I'll abbreviate covenant there. 1 Thessalonians 5:24, faithful is he who called you, who also will do it. 2 Timothy 2:13, if we are faithless, he remains faithful. He cannot deny himself. Psalm 36:5, your mercy, O Lord, is in the heavens. Your faithfulness reaches to the clouds. God's faithfulness, like all of his attributes, is infinite. And then think of Lamentations 3, 22 and 23. It is of the Lord's mercies that we are not consumed, because his compassion fails not. They are new every morning. Great is thy faithfulness. To him, great is thy faithfulness. So, what was the greatest redemptive act in the Old Testament? Was the Exodus. And that Exodus then was not completed until the temple was built, a solid foundation, God's permanent dwelling place. It came to pass in the 480th year of the children of Israel had come out of the land of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, in the month of Ziv, which is the second month, that he began to build the house of the Lord. And notice there it's capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D. Yahweh, the covenant God. Intimacy with God. Intimacy with God. When we think of the first commandment. You shall have no other gods before me. Three things. Albert Mohler says three things are signified in that first commandment. It's monotheism, one God, it's ultimate allegiance to God and God alone, ultimate allegiance to God and God alone, and then it's exclusivity. Jeremiah 23:13, he's unique. Or Isaiah 46:9. Remember the former things of old, for I am God. I am God and there is no one else. He's the only living God. Exclusivity. So when we look at David, what were David's two biggest sins? First one, 2 Samuel chapter 11, Bathsheba, and then the murder, adultery with Bathsheba, and the murder of Uriah. And the second one would be that census then in 1 Chronicles 21. That would be his two biggest ones. So as a result of that, David purchased that property on Mount Moriah. See, that's the significance of it all. God had that, of course, all in his predetermined plan. Now we have Solomon building the temple on David's property on Mount Moriah. Mount Moriah. So God took the consequences of David's two worst sins, a piece of property and a son, and he built the temple. Really remarkable. But where sin abounded, grace did much more abound. Romans 5:20. And that's an encouragement for us too. When you think, you know, the devil would have us believe that, you know, you commit some sin, even, you know, not just a little one, but a big sin or something, well, then God can't use you and all that. No, there's forgiveness. There's a forsaking of sin with a forgiveness, and God can use you. Think of Saul of Tarsus. When you read Acts 26:9-11, where because of his zeal, he thought he was doing it all for God, and what did he do? He was causing the children of God to blaspheme. He was putting him in prison, and he was there when Stephen was murdered and everything. And yet how God was forgiveness there with God, and how God used Saul of Tarsus, the Apostle Paul. So now, the second point. Second point, God's dwelling, its exterior structure, verses 2 and 10 and 36-38. So what I mentioned there, there's kind of verse 1 there and 2 trying it with verse 37. It kind of ties it all together almost like an inclusio. So you just tie the whole chapter together. Verse 2. Now the house which King Solomon built for the Lord, its length was 60 cubits, width was 20 cubits, height was 30 cubits. Now, when you start talking a cubit, the elbow, the forearm, to the tip of the middle finger. To the tip of the middle finger. Now, there's a short cubit, or a common one. And that's the one, 2 Chronicles 3:3, that's the one that's used for measuring here everything that we're going to get into here. 2 Chronicles 3:3. This is the foundation which Solomon laid for building the house of the God. The length was 60 cubits according to the former measure, which is the common measure, okay? Common measure. 2 Chronicles 3:3. This one was 18 inches. And then there was a long cubit. That was 21 inches. Now, I was thinking of myself. My dad had long arms. I took after my mom's side. I got short arms. Well, if you take me from the elbow to the tip of my middle finger, I didn't measure it, but, you know, it's not the 21 inches. I'd be the shorter one. And then I was thinking of Kevin McHale. He played basketball for the University of Minnesota. He was All-State in high school for Hibbing, and then played for the University of Minnesota, went on to in the pros for the Boston Celtics, and now is in the Hall of Fame. His mother was 5'6". His dad was 5'10". And he was 6'11". Now, what happened? I'll never forget, I saw a picture of them once. Mom was standing there, you know, she was a squat lady, you know, 5'6", and the dad was standing there. And here's the son, way up here, see. But Kevin McHale had arms. See, mine go down and my knees are here. Well, he's 6'11", but his arms hung down like this. So you could imagine his wingspan when it came to basketball and everything, see. And can you imagine if we go from his elbow to the tip of his middle finger, I think we'd have to have an extra long cubit we'd probably have there, see. So, but here we've got the short cubit is the common cubit, okay? That's what we're going by here. Now, note your, let me get the, you got to get these handouts here now. So I, oh, yes. Yeah, the average height of the Jew in Jesus' day was 5'2". And the sides of their boats, when they'd go out on the Sea of Galilee, was 4'10". So when Peter says, like in Matthew 14, where he says, "Can I come to you, Lord?" Imagine, it's 4'10", he's 5'2". So he has to climb over to get out. Now, when Richard the Lionhearted, in the Middle Ages there, time of Robin Hood, went to the Jerusalem on the Crusades, he was 6'2". Richard the Lionheart. Now, I've watched the Robin Hood movie, and I noticed that they picked a taller guy, so whoever was the historian there, he helped get that right. Because he had Richard the Lionheart up here, and everybody else is down here. See, that's the way it is. And by the way, with all the armor they wore in the summers there in that, they said you could smell the army coming miles away. Miles away. Okay, now I got to get all these three, and then we'll get into a discussion here on this. I got to get the third one here. Yeah, here we go. Okay, now. Okay, take this one first here. Okay. Now. Says here, verse 2, the temple then, its length was 60 cubits, that's 90 feet, okay? So that would be the holy place and the most holy place. 40 cubits would be 60 feet, 20 cubits is 30 feet, okay? So we got a total of 90 feet long, okay? The width of it is 20 cubits or 30 feet, the width of it. Okay? Everybody with me? Okay. Now, when we compare this to the tabernacle, does anybody remember on the tabernacle? This is important. The tabernacle was 45 feet long, the holy place, the most holy place, and 15 feet wide. So the Temple of Solomon, compared to the tabernacle, was twice as big. 90 feet long, 30 feet wide, instead of 45 and 15. So when we're talking the most holy place, remember, we said it was a 15-foot cube. Well, this is a 30-foot cube. 30-foot cube. Now, there's a little wrinkle here yet we'll come up with here, but stay tuned. Okay, so now the house then was, we got that long. It was 60 feet long. Let's see, 60 cube, 90 feet. Its length was 90 feet. 60 cubits is 90 feet. And then the width was 20 cubits, which is 30 feet. Got that? 90 by 30. Okay. Now its height, here's the wrinkle. Its height was 45 feet. What did I say? Most holy plate was a 30-foot cube. 30-foot cube was the most holy place. There's 15 feet extra. That 15 feet extra is an attic. An attic. And we don't know exactly what it was used for, but probably used for storage of some kind, okay? An attic space, 15 feet above. We're not told how it was used, okay? Everybody with me now, so far. Okay, now, let's go verse 3. The vestibule. This vestibule, you can call it a portico or the porch. Portico or a porch, okay? Now, notice on your handout there, you see the porch. By the way, if we put an east, west, north, south on this, what would be the directions on this? Anybody? The entry is east. Always east. The tabernacle entry was east. The temple is always east. It looks toward east, and why?
Yes. Yeah.
Somebody else. I yield my time. Okay. What does it say in Matthew? I should have had this reference. Let's see. I know about where it is here. That's right. Oh, yeah, here it is. Matthew 24:27. For as the lightning comes from the east and flashes to the west, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. Matthew 24:27. So that's why this faces east. Matthew 24:27. Jesus comes out of the east. Out of the east. Okay. So we got an east, and then we'd have a west, and then the north, and the south. Okay. Now, very important here. I got to get this right. Turn to 2 Chronicles 3:17. 2 Chronicles 3:17. Okay. 2 Chronicles 3:17. Now that gives us the name here of these two pillars. You see on your other diagram here of the temple? You see the two pillars in front? Okay, that's what we're going to talk about now, the two pillars. Okay, the two pillars here on the front of the porch. Then he set up the pillars before the temple. This is in front then, right in front of this 15-foot porch. One on the right hand, the other on the left hand. The name of the one on the right hand is Jochen, which literally means he shall establish. Okay? He shall establish. The name of the other on the left hand, that's how you're, when you're facing the opening there then, right hand, left hand. Left hand is Boaz. Boaz means it is strength. It is strength. Okay? He shall establish and it is strength. That's the name of the two pillars then. The two pillars. Okay? Now, let's go back here to 1 Kings 6, verse 4. And he made for the house windows with beveled frames. Okay? See the handout here now? Windows with the beveled frames are these up here. Up here. Okay? The NIV calls them clerestory windows. NIV calls them clerestory windows. Now, we read windows with beveled frames. The Living Bible just calls them narrow windows. Narrow windows throughout. In our sanctuary, we have four windows, and they're fairly narrow, you know, considering the size of the building and all that, narrow windows. Now, the Jerusalem Bible is interesting. He said he made windows. This is the Jerusalem Bible now. He made windows for the temple. With frames and lattice work. And lattice work. Nancy, you know about lattice work? You're nodding yes? How do you know about lattice? There are the strips on our windows at our house. That's lattice. Yeah, if we were to replace our windows now, we can't get lattice. Can't buy the lattice windows. But that's interesting there on the Jerusalem Bible. Okay? That's these windows now we're referring to across the top. Now, anybody remember in the tabernacle, were there windows? What was the lighting in the tabernacle? Candles, the menorah, right? Remember that? Okay, and how about in this temple? Did you know what they had? They had five menorahs on the north and five menorahs on the south. They had multiple menorahs in there for lighting. Now you're beginning to understand, you see, that I this to me was a mumbo jumbo until I had some picture which helped me. Help me get this sorted in my mind. Now, verse 5. Against the wall of the temple, he built chambers all around against the walls of the temple. Now, chambers here, we can call them storage rooms. Storage rooms. Okay? Now, what we're going to be talking here is you can see here on this diagram, storerooms. See? So what sides are we talking about here? We're talking about north, west, and south. Three sides, the storerooms. Three sides, storerooms around the temple itself. Okay? On the outside wall. Outside of the wall of the temple. And you see that in the other diagram here. You see that? You've got the outer wall of the temple, and then what is the storage rooms are on three different levels. Storage rooms are on three different levels. Okay? Verse 5, against the wall of the building, he built chambers all around against the walls of the temple, all around the sanctuary and the inner sanctuary. The sanctuary is the holy place, and the most holy place is the inner sanctuary. Okay? He made side chambers all around it. Now, all around it, except on the east, because the east is the opening. So on three sides, north, west, and south. Now, verse 6. By the way, Jerusalem Bible called the chamber here. This was interesting, too. Storage room. The Jerusalem Bible calls it an annex. Annex. Okay. Now, verse 6. The lowest chamber was 5 cubits wide. That'd be 7.5 feet wide. See the diagram now? This one here? This one here? It's 5 cubits high, which is 7.5 feet high. Each level here, three different stories of these storage rooms, three different levels, each of them is 7.5 feet high in height. Okay? When we have our homes, what's the height of the roofs in our homes, standard in America? think 8 is standard. The older ones were taller yet. Yeah, some of them are 12 feet or whatever. 10, 12. One-story building, you roughly figure 10 feet for a one-story building. So if you had a 10-story skyscraper, you'd have what? Basically figure 100 feet tall. But this is 7.5 feet, and the first one was 7.5 feet, okay? Then verse 6, he says, the lowest chamber was 5 cubits wide, the middle was 6 cubits wide. That's 9 feet wide. And then the upper one, the third, was 7 cubits wide, 10.5 feet. Now, at the end of the verse, I find this really interesting. Around the outside of the temple, so that the support beams, for he made narrow ledges around the outside of the temple so that the support beams would not be fastened into the walls of the temple. Okay? So see this? The outer temple wall, what? It's thickest on the bottom, and you've got a ledge. And then, second story, it's a little less thick, and then you've got a ledge at the top, and then it's less thick again. See? So each story is resting on that, but there's no fastening then to the outer wall of the temple. See? But yet they're resting on it, and they're not going anywhere. See? Okay. Narrow ledges around the outside of the temple on those three sides so that the support beams would not be fastened into the walls of the temple. Okay? Now that ties in basically with verse 7. See, because it's the temple, the Lord's dwelling place. Now remember, when we compared the temple here with the tabernacle, the tabernacle didn't have any of these storage things and all that above it. And notice here, this diagram here, notice it, 3 different levels of windows. See that? 3 different levels of windows. So each of those stories, these storage rooms, they get lighting in from these small windows. Yeah, that could very well be. Now, verse 7. And the temple, when it was being built, was built with stone, finished at the quarry, so that no hammer or chisel or any iron tool was heard in the temple while it was being built. It was interesting, the other day I was listening on the news and President Trump was at the podium at the White House in the Rose Garden there, and he was saying, you hear that sound? You hear that noise? Well, what are they doing? They're constructing the big, beautiful ballroom. And so he says, you hear that noise? Ah, I love that sound, he says. It's the sound of money. It's the sound of money. So, but here in the temple, he'd hear no noise. No noise at all. And so you and I say what? There never was a building project like that ever before or since. No noise whatsoever. And why is that? God's help. What I liken it to is when I've told you this before, but when I was a grade school kid and we attended the Covenant Church in Wilmer. My dad would say on Sunday morning during the service, you know, I'm first grade or whatever, as long as I could be occupied, you know, drawing or, you know, fooling around something, building something on the floor, doing something, as long as I didn't make a peep, I was all right. As long as I didn't make a peep and I was quiet during the service. But if I made a noise, this is what happened. I mean, I got my ear jerked, I got outside, I got a spanking, and then I came back in. Okay. But I remember distinctly, I was on the floor, and all of a sudden I heard the sound. The Lord is in his holy temple. The Lord is in his holy temple. And all ears shall keep silence before him. And it was Habakkuk 2:20. And the choir was in the choir loft. And they weren't up front like they were usually were. And all of a sudden I heard that sound, you know, just, the Lord is in his holy temple. It wasn't, you know, a loud sound or anything. And all of a sudden it got my attention. You know, here's this little kid poking his head up, you know, looking around, where is this coming from? He couldn't figure it out, you know. And here the choir was in the choir loft singing Habakkuk 2:20. But it's that same thing, see? reverence and awe. And there's totally different things. See, the Lord's in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before him. So, the silence is twofold. We could say that it has to do with Solomon and his wisdom as far as the building of it. But also the main thing is the holiness of God. It points to the holy, it's a witness to the holiness of God. Preparation of the stones. You and I are called what? In 1 Peter 2:5, what do we call? Living stones. Living stones. Now remember, you and I in Romans 12, I beseech you therefore, brethren, to present your bodies a living sacrifice. Living sacrifice. What's the problem Vance Havner, the old preacher, said about living sacrifices? He says they tend to squirm off the altar. And so you think of living stones. Well, these quarried stones didn't move. They stayed put. Whereas living stones, you know, they tend to have a little problem staying put. But God is not finished with us yet. He's still chiseling away on us. And all through life, we're basically in the quarry getting shaped in our sanctification for God's glory. Think of our quiet times of prayer. We're supposed to have a quiet time, a devotion time with the Lord every day. We shouldn't have a lot of commotion and all that when we do that, when we commune with God during our quiet times. And that's another thing, you know, there are some sanctuaries when you come in on Sunday morning. We have that in our bulletin, quiet time. Usually what happens when Nancy starts playing the piano on Sunday morning, really, that should be the cue for everybody to button it up. So do not to be talking and yapping. Turn your attention then completely to God as far as what she's playing on the piano and all that. It should be quiet then before it starts. Okay, let's look now at verse 8. The doorway for the middle story was on the right side of the temple. They went up to the stairs, from the middle story from middle to the third. So you see what you've got here? You've got our way in here. And then what you've got is basically a spiral staircase, kind of a spiral staircase to go up to these floors, from the smallest then to the largest then, three stories as far as storage. Now, verse 9. So he built the temple and finished it. And he paneled the temple with beams and boards of cedar. Now remember, we went through that in chapter 5. Remember, he worked out the deal with Hiram where the cedars came from Lebanon, Tyre, and Sidon down. And they came down by raft, and then they disassembled it, and then they took it the 25-30 miles to the site. But one thing, 2 Chronicles 1:15, Solomon made silver and gold as common in Jerusalem as the stones, and the cedars as abundant as the sycamores that are in the lowland. So they got cedars all over. And he's using these cedars here and paneling and everything on the inside and that. Now, one thing that's interesting to me that he didn't mention is that when we think of cedar, what do we think of? Cedar chests, cedar closets, and all this kind of stuff. Well, when you have cedar chests and cedar closets, what's with that? Keeps bugs away, yeah, but it's aromatic also, right? It's got that kind of neat cedar smell. They didn't mention any of that here. I'm wondering if there was that too. I don't know. They're just speculating because nobody mentioned it. See. Now, here's a side note that I came across was interesting. That Hiram provided Solomon with all this wood. And remember they had this exchange, you know, where Solomon was going to provide all this food, you know, and everything for Hiram. Well, as it turned out, Solomon ran up a bill he couldn't pay immediately. He couldn't pay it immediately. So Hiram loaned him some gold. And then as collateral, Solomon gave him 20 cities on the border of Galilee and Phoenicia. But Hiram wasn't pleased with that. Now we'll get to that when we get to 1 Kings 9. But later, Solomon was paid his debt and he could reclaim the cities. Later he paid his debt and he reclaimed the cities. 2 Chronicles 8:1. Now, here's what this commentator said here. Of course, all these payments for food and gold came out of the pockets of the Jewish people, so it's no wonder they protested and asked for relief after Solomon died in 1 Kings 12. Is that true or false? That's false. All of this gold and it didn't come out of the people's pockets. They didn't have it. So where did it come from? Well, did a little investigating. Turn with me. I'll give you just one example. Turn with me to 1 Kings 10, verses 1 and 2. 1 Kings 10, 1 and 2. Now when the queen of Sheba heard of the fame of Solomon concerning the name of the Lord, she came to test him with hard questions. She came to Jerusalem with a very great retinue with camels that bore spices, very much gold, and precious stones. And when she came to Solomon, she spoke with him all about that was in her heart. And all these nations around Solomon, what did they do? They paid tribute to Solomon. It's like ancient tariffs. Money was coming in. Gold was coming in. Gold and silver was coming in. So, of course, Solomon was able then to pay it back. It didn't come out of the people's pockets. They didn't have that kind of money. Let's go then. And he built side chambers, verse 10, against the entire temple, each 5 cubits high. They were attached to the temple with cedar beams. Okay? Remember those cedar beams, and they didn't penetrate the outer wall of the temple. Remember, they rested on the ledges. Rested on the ledges. Okay, now let's go to verses 36 to 38. 36 to 38. This is interesting. He built the inner court. Inner court. With 3 rows of hewn stone and a row of cedar beams. The inner court refers to there, you had a courtyard for the priests that surrounded the holy place. If you go in the temple in Jesus' time, remember, there was the outer one, which was for the Gentiles. And then there was a 5-foot wall where you had the court of the women. And that was only for Israelites that could go in there. And they had signs here that if any Gentile came in here, they'd be killed. Okay? Then you see, then you went to the court of Israel. Men only, and then you went to the court of the priests. And the court of the priests, this was elevated. You kept going up, and the court of the priests then surrounded the sanctuary here and the inner sanctuary. The holy place and the most holy place. Now, if you were an Israelite man, see, in the court of Israel, you had total vision here of the priests and what was going on and all of that. So you could see all of that. But there was an ascendancy there, steps up here. But this is what they're talking about here. And it was interesting. It was separated here. They had a wall composed of stone blocks and wood. And what's the purpose here? A row of cedar beams, placing the wood between the stones, because then that serves as a protection against earthquake damage. Protection against earthquake damage. They have the wood intermixed with the stones. Okay? Now, verse 37. Here's the repetition verse again. In the 4th year, the foundation of the house of the Lord was laid in the month of Ziv, the month of April or May. 4 years. Let's see. So, the first 4 years of his reign, what did Solomon do then? That was accumulation of these materials. Remember, we talked about before. That'd be 970 to 966. And then in 966 here, then he began the building of the temple. And in verse 38, just to remind you again, this building of the temple, the foundation would be the official end of the Exodus, end of the wanderings. Verse 38, and in the 11th year, the month of Bul, which is October, November, 8th month, the house was finished in all of its details, according to all its plans. So it was 7 years in building it. Some would say 7.5 years, whatever. There we get into that again. But 11 years into Solomon's reign. So he began in if he began in 966 and 7 years later, you see, then you're talking 959 BC, which would be 11 years into his reign because he started in 970. So he finished the house of the Lord.
Yeah.
Finished what he began. And remember, Solomon's attitude and everything was good on this. And we'll get into this verses next time. We don't have time tonight. But we'll start at verse 11 through 13 next time. And it's interesting, there's a concern here. And why is there a concern in that, verses 11 through 13? But we'll leave that hanging until next time, okay?